Did Charlotte's Web scare the heck out of you as a kid? All that talk about death? A new biography looks at the man behind Charlotte's Web, the writer E.B. White, and how the harsh truths about nature and mortality were inspired by a real spider and a real farm. Plus, a new musical instrument and a way to make your golf ball fly further. Both winners of the Kids Science Challenge, they join us. Oh, and by the way, they're just entering the fourth grade. And the video pick of the week?
Poop and paddle.
A floating outhouse made for the sea. And believe me, seeing is believing. Stay with us, all coming up.
You can support the show by trying Audible.com with over 75,000 audiobooks, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/Science Friday. Now on to the show.
This is Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. You know that TV show about being smarter than a fifth grader? I want to introduce you to two kids who are just entering the fourth grade this year, who are going to give those fifth graders a run for their smarts. They're two winners of the Kids Science Challenge. That's a competition put together by the creator of the Pulse of the Planet radio program, you know, veteran Jim Metzner. But instead of a robot competition like FIRST Robotics, this one challenges kids to, in the third to sixth grades, to think about a problem, a question, a need that science could solve. And then the winners get paired up with a science mentor, a scientist, to explore their idea and find the solution. You can find out more about it or learn how to enter next year at kidsciencechallenge.com. And we have two of the winners with us here today. Mary Benjamin will be entering the fourth grade at Pine Cobble School in Williamstown, Massachusetts. Her entry was the winner in the Sensational Sounds category of Kids Science Challenge. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Hi, thank you.
You're welcome. Nice to have you. Peyton Robertson, incoming fourth grader at Pinecrest School in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. His idea was the winner in the Super Stuff for Sports category. Welcome, Peyton.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. If you're a kid with an idea, you'd like to talk with our kids, our number is 1-800-989-8255, or you can tweet us at SciFry at SCI. FRI. Mary, let me begin with you. Tell us about your project. What was that?
Well, I took two spray bottles, or two or three or four, or something like that, and I pretty much just sprayed water into a tin can, and the tin can had a tube attached to it, and it led back into the spray bottle, so you would never run out of water.
Hmm. And you were making a musical instrument?
Yeah.
By spraying the tin can and, I guess, changing the sound by how? How did you change the different sounds the can would make?
We found different kinds of cans, and we also tuned them a little bit by putting pressure on them, because you can tune tin cans if you put pressure on them, they become higher. Also, if the tin cans have bigger ridges on the bottom, then they're higher too.
Hmm. All right, we have actually a little bit of music that you played for us on your tin can. Let's have a listen. All right. That's Ode to Joy, is it not?
Yep.
I could recognize that. That's very good. Peyton, you had a different project. What was your project?
I love golf. I play golf every weekend. And my idea was to create a ball warmer, which would preserve the golf ball's temperature so it doesn't lose distance. Because from my experiment, I noticed that a golf ball doesn't fly as far when it's cold.
So you made a ball warmer, a golf ball warmer. How does that work?
Well, we never actually made it, but here's what I thought it would look like. I thought it would be like a thermos technology. So it would be a vacuum flask, and there would be four or five different compartments. Each compartment would hold a ball, and it would keep the ball's temperature. It would keep the ball's temperature the same. So in the cold parts of the country, the performance could still be consistent.
And what kind of research did you do in preparing for this?
Well, I cracked open several golf balls.
That's not an easy thing to do, cracking open.
Well, my talents help me. I also Googled how golf balls are made.
Right.
And I heated one. I heated 10 balls on. My parents heated 10 balls on the stove. We kept 10 at room temperature, and I put 10 in the freezer. And then we dropped all 30 of them off the top of a ladder, and we measured how high they bounced. And the hot and the room temperature balls bounced significantly higher than the cold balls.
Wow, you did a real science experiment there. Then you collected data, you did the experiment, an idea, and it all worked out. Is there a product here you think it can market something that keep golf balls a little higher to work well? And does it violate any golfing rules when you do that?
Heating it in like a microwave is not legal, but we're pretty sure that just keeping the temperature constant is legal.
Did you actually try to hit some golf balls or have them hit at all at a higher temperature? Did they go any further, or could you discover anything about them? You'd bounce them, and that was high enough, I guess.
When we went to my reward for winning was to go to the University of Southern Mississippi, and I met Dr. Savin, and we made some golf balls out of a super elastic polymer.
Right.
That would perform well at any temperature.
Wow.
And I got to hit those balls, and they definitely went further than regular balls.
All right, Titleist, watch out. Mary, how did you get your idea to work on this?
It's kind of a funny story. I was really running out of time to come up with an idea. I had come up with ideas for both the other categories, but I had no idea for this one. It was going to be very difficult to come up with an idea. But I thought about what they had said about thinking about something that no one would really guess could be a musical instrument. And then I looked around my room, and the first thing that I saw was a spray bottle, which I used to clean my guinea pig cage. And then pretty much the idea just popped into my head. And I went downstairs. I said, "Dad, I have an idea." I did a couple experiments, and that was pretty much it.
It's interesting that you were not afraid to tell people about your idea, that you might be afraid they might laugh at you.
Not really.
Yeah.
I didn't really tell, I kind of told them about my idea, but I wasn't really allowed to tell them that I had won. So it's hard to explain everything.
Yeah. Do you think someone else will build your idea and market it?
I don't know. But my aunt is a musician, and she said that she might use it in one of her concerts. So wow. That's pretty cool.
Did you have to experiment with different kinds of objects to find out which one made the best sound?
Yeah. I built two prototypes before I went to California, which is where I got to go because I won. And before I went there, I built two prototypes. They didn't look very much like the final product, but and I had to do a lot of experimenting with which sounds worked best until I decided that tin cans. What worked.
I have a question for both of you. Actually, it was one that I was going to ask, but came in a tweet from Baby Lou, who says, "What do you say to kids who think science is boring and useless? What do you say to them?"
I didn't always love science. You just gotta experiment. You have to come up with fun activities that you can do yourself that you learn from and that are very entertaining. And pretty much after that, you just kind of love science.
Mm-hmm. Peyton, do you have an answer for that?
I think that you shouldn't think about it as science. You should think about it as how things work. Because if you think about it that way, then it becomes much, much more interesting.
Just don't call it science. Just try to figure out how the world works.
Right.
Do you have a follow-up? Do you have any other idea you're working on now?
Not really. Just... I hope to make a prototype of my ball warmer, but besides that,
yeah, some other idea, and we'll hit you. And Mary, do you have any improvement that you can make or a follow up?
I've been kind of thinking about that. I've been experimenting with the one that I built,
mm-hmm.
and trying to come up with ways to make it better. So it's kind of an interesting project. I'm like drawing pictures of ways that it could become more interesting. Mine's the one that I built is portable. We used Velcro to make it. But it's still pretty big, so I'm trying to come up with a way that maybe next time, it'll be more portable.
Hmm. Let me ask you both. What do your friends say about what you're doing?
Well, I haven't talked to them in a while. I've been away for most of the summer, but was allowed to tell them right before school ended. But they seem pretty excited, interested. When I went to California, they put lots and lots of questions on my blog the questions that they had that I could think about when I built it, and then maybe I could answer them.
Well, I want to thank both of you for taking time with us, and good luck to you, too. Mary Benjamin of Williamstown, Massachusetts, Peyton Robertson of Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Two winners of the Kids Science Challenge. You can find out more about that at kidsciencechallenge.com or go to our website. Good luck to you both, and thanks for coming on Science Friday.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You. Hope to see you on your next project.
This episode of Science Friday is sponsored by Audible.com, which is a leading provider of audiobooks with more than 75,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For listeners of Science Friday, Audible is offering a free audiobook of your choice when you try Audible free for 14 days. One audiobook Science Friday listeners might enjoy is Robopocalypse by Daniel H. Wilson. You may remember Dan from a discussion with Ira on a recent episode of the show to discuss his book about robots taking over the world. And you can get Robopocalypse for free on Audible. Another audiobook is The Quantum Story, A History in 40 Moments by Jim Baggett. Jim suggests that to have a better understanding of what is happening in science today with the Large Hadron Collider and CERN, you need to know something about the history which precedes them. That's The Quantum Story, A History in 40 Moments by Jim Baggett, available on Audible. And if you'd like to see books Ira is listening to now, go to our Facebook page at facebook.com/SciFry and check out Ira's Best Listens book list. To try Audible today with a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/Science Friday. That's audible.com/Science Friday. Now back to the show.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Where is Papa going with that axe? It is probably one of the most famous opening sentences in all of literature. And if you're between the ages of 8 and 80, you probably recognize that line. It's the first line of Charlotte's Web, written by E.B. White. The book was published in the 50s, but it hasn't lost any of its appeal. And even now, the story of Wilbur the pig, his impending murder, and the spider who comes to his rescue continues to be read by kids and adults all over the world. Talking animals and spelling spiders may not sound like the writings of a naturalist, but in his new book, my next guest argues that it was E.B. White's observation and appreciation of nature and its kinship with animals that makes Charlotte's Web so appealing. Michael Sims' new book is called The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature and the Birth of an American Classic. He joins us from KQED. In Pittsburgh. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. My pleasure.
How did you get interested in Charlotte's Web to devote a whole book about it?
Well, the project really got out of hand. I originally thought I would do a natural history of children's animal stories, all those talking animal stories like The Wind in the Willows and Winnie the Pooh. And I started with Charlotte and Wilbur, and I never got any further because I just became really preoccupied with E.B. White's personality and how he went about this project.
You know, when most of us think about E.B. White, we don't usually think of him as a naturalist, but you discovered from his writings that he really was.
That's one of the things I'd always enjoyed about him a lot, was that he always wrote about nature. I don't mean everything he wrote, but he constantly returned to nature throughout his life. And even in his early unsigned writings for The New Yorker, he was exploring the city and writing about urban natural history, even in the late 20s.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Michael Sims about the story of Charlotte's Web and his book. Now, I guess the first big thing you understand, and it's a nice thing to discover from reading your book, is that he really did have a farm with all those animals and characters on the farm, did he not?
Yes. We expect somebody like Philip Roth to base characters on people he knew in everyday life. But the fun thing is you discover that people such as E.B. White was basing his characters on, in a sense, his friends and neighbors every day around the farm and in the barn.
And so he did raise pigs, right?
He did raise pigs. He did have a beautiful barn. I was there again about 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago on the coast of Maine. And he had cattle and sheep. He was familiar with geese. He was familiar with the whole routine for decades. And their actual real lives is what inspired the story of Charlotte's Web.
So Wilbur really was based on a real pig.
There was a real pig. There had been several, but there was a particular one. White was also a wonderful essayist, as you know, and one of his now classic essays is called Death of a Pig, and it was about a pig that he had, that he, being the farmer and, in a sense, the villain behind Charlotte's Web, was really E.B. White, because he was the man who was going to kill the pig. Even though this pig was doomed for slaughter in the fall, when it got sick, he did everything he could to save its life, and he failed. And the pig died, and yet it sort of stayed alive in his imagination.
And yet, you talk about it, he also showed the irony of that whole situation, saving a pig so you could kill it later.
Yes, that was one of the things I like about White, and one of the reasons he was congenial to spend so much time with, is he will admit the ironies of life. He won't try to solve things in the way that the Charlotte's Web doesn't try to solve death. It just faces it as a part of life. And so he admitted this was absolutely crazy, that he felt so sad. And in the end, he said he did feel a sense of loss when the pig died, not as if he'd just lost some future bacon, but as if he had lost, he had dealt with a fellow creature who was suffering in a suffering world.
Mm-hmm. And the famous opening line of the book, you revealed to us that line, "Where is Papa going with that axe?" was added way at the end of his writing. It was not...
Yes. Yes. That's always an interesting thing for me, is to go into someone's work and discover how very hard they had to work and how long it took them to get to what seems inevitable to us. I mean, the story is so distilled and simple and straightforward. It took him forever to get there. And Fern herself wasn't even added until the last draft.
And it is, and you say, as you say in your book, it is a terrific one of, if not the best opening line of a novel.
Oh, I think it's wonderful. And I agree with something you said the other day, that it sounds like something in a Hitchcock movie.
I wrote that in my blog. Yeah, it's true.
I saw that, yes. Very psycho. You know, you worry where the crazy mother is in the other room.
And that's the joy of this book, is that it's really not a kid's book. I mean, or it speaks to kids as an adult. About the reality of life. You know, Charlotte is a spider that eats, just munches on flies during the whole book, you know, as if
yes.
This is what they do.
I love that. Yes. He just, that was one of his complaints about Disney. He said, you know, Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse are amusing, but there's no reason for them to be a duck or a mouse. It has nothing to do with what they actually do. They drive a truck around or whatever. And he said, his characters emerged from real animals he knew, and that's why he wanted to do very careful research to get it right behind the scenes.
Okay, then that's a good intro for me, good segue, because we have actually have a little snippet of E.B. White reading a little bit from Charlotte's Web about the scene where Charlotte and Wilbur are talking about what goes on in her web.
"My name," said the spider, "is Charlotte." "Charlotte what?" asked Wilbur eagerly. "Charlotte A. Cavatica, but just call me Charlotte." "I think you're beautiful," said Wilbur. "Well, I am pretty," replied Charlotte. "There's no denying that. Almost all spiders are rather nice looking. I'm not as flashy as some, but I'll do. I wish I could see you, Wilbur, as clearly as you can see me." "Why can't you?" asked the pig. "I'm right here." "Yes, but I'm nearsighted," replied Charlotte. "I've always been dreadfully nearsighted. It's good in some ways, not so good in others. Watch me wrap up this fly." A fly that had been crawling along Wilbur's trough had flown up and blundered into the lower part of Charlotte's web and was tangled in the sticky threads. The fly was beating its wings furiously, trying to break loose and free itself. "First," said Charlotte, "I dive at him." She plunged headfirst toward the fly. As she dropped, a tiny silken thread unwound from her rear end. "Next, I wrap him up." She grabbed the fly, threw a few jets of silk around it, and rolled it over and over, wrapping it so that it couldn't move. Wilbur watched in horror. He could hardly believe what he was seeing, and although he detested flies, he was sorry for this one. "There," said Charlotte. "Now I knock him out, so he'll be more comfortable."
And that's E.B. White reading a bit of his own book from Charlotte's Web. And that we've got that from Audible.com. You can actually download that and get that copy of him reading it at Audible. And the thing that you point out in this book and that it is obvious from reading Charlotte's Web is that E.B. White pulls no punches here about what real life is about.
Yes, it's surely the only children's book, at least by that time in 1952, that had a heroine who calmly killed other creatures right in the front of the audience, right in the main stage. I mean, it was just when he read that spiders anesthetize their prey to paralyze it, he does an immediate quick spin on that and decides, what the heck, let's put that into it.
It's amazing because the beauty is in the details here. And you point out that E.B. White puts in the great details about how nature works, even the name of the spider.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Tell us about the name.
He had originally thought her name was going to be Charlotte Epeira, which he thought was the scientific name. And he learned that Cavatica was an older name for the same species. And he... when he put together her name, Charlotte A. Cavatica came from Arania Cavatica, which was her scientific name, and it's now changed. The form has changed as taxonomy always evolves, but to Arrhenius Cavaticus. But so he changes it and reduces her genus name to a middle initial, and suddenly her species name becomes this beautiful, jaunty Italian surname, and you have Charlotte A. Cavatica, a Dickensian, memorable sort of name.
And he goes through he has the spider tell us about all the body parts and all the anatomically correct things that we would learn in nature, as if this were a science class taught as a kid's book.
It's really strange that he will have her list the parts of the leg, you know, the femur, the patella, the metatarsus, and all this. And he in the passage you just read, he made a note carefully and emphasized it when he learned that spiders are usually nearsighted.
Right.
He had very carefully asked himself questions such as, when the web material, the filament, comes out of the spinneret, the web-producing organ on the bottom of the spider's body, does it have to touch the object that it's attaching to, or can the foot move it? And so there he just says, silken thread unwound from her rear end, and she looped it around. And so there, even behind all that, was page after page of very careful, detailed research in five different science books that I know of.
Amazing. And even in his research, you write that he noticed a real spider laying an egg sac and brought it home with him.
Yes,
with some interesting results.
Yes, I think that's my favorite part of the book, is that he's carrying slops out for the pig every day in the barn, the replacement pig for the one that died. And he keeps walking under this spider web, and he watches every day, and eventually he sees a round object in it and goes up and examines it and realizes the spider has created an egg case and is filling it with eggs. So then he doesn't see her again after that, and at this point he doesn't yet understand that this species of spider dies after laying eggs. So he doesn't see it for a while, and then he has to go back to New York City to the other end of this loop of his life from rural Maine to urban New York. Mm-hmm. And he cuts the spider, the egg sac down, takes it with him, puts it on his bureau in his apartment in New York, and forgets about it until one day he's combing his hair, and he sees this movement on the desk, and the next thing you know, spiders are coming out of these little holes in a box that he had put the web case in, and the egg case. And they're beginning to climb out and spill across the bureau. And because he's E.B. White, unlike me, he thinks this is very cool. And then they gradually begin to create the little ballooning filament that enables them to fly off wherever, to trust the wind and chance. Mm-hmm. And so they begin to fly around the room, and he thinks that's cool. Until the maid absolutely flatly refuses to work around a spider refugee camp. And they had to go.
It's a great story. 1-800-989-8255. We're talking with Michael Sims. His new book is The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature and the Birth of an American Classic. It's great. It's great. It's a lot of fun to read. And I have to admit, I had not read Charlotte's Web before I read your book. And I read it first. And it is a classic. And it is still being read by adults, correct?
Oh, constantly. Yeah. I mean, it's being taught in so many literature classes. And I'm glad that I was able to put you onto a book, considering over the years how many books you've put me onto.
Well, thank you. I'm glad I could return the favor. We're talking about Charlotte's Web this hour on Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow with Michael Sims. Let's see if we can get a phone call in before the break. Amy in Shinglehouse, Pennsylvania. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
I read Charlotte's Web when I was 8. Which was 1977, and I loved it, and I just thought it was fabulous, and the spiders eating, you know, the spider eating the flies didn't bother me at all. What I did not see Charlotte dying at the end. I just didn't see it coming, and it really did me in. I just sat in my little rocking chair sobbing, and my mother found me crying and crying, and she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Charlotte died." She was like, "Oh." You know, maybe she thought she should have warned me about that. But, you know, I read The Trumpet of the Swan out loud to my kids, but I can't read Charlotte's Web out loud to them.
Because of the
ending. Because I know it'll get me.
Right. Good point. Michael, even E.B. White had trouble with that, did he not?
He did. That's a wonderful story, Amy. And I agree. E.B. White had a version of that when he was doing the audio many years later. The producer later said that it took him 17 takes to read the death scene of Charlotte. And finally they would walk outside and E.B. White would go, "This is ridiculous. A grown man crying over the death of an imaginary insect." And then he would go in and start crying again when he got to that moment.
Wow. But that's true, again, that's true to how nature works. He did not try to, you know, to cover it up.
And before people call in, I just want to mention, I know a spider's not an insect.
An arachnid. Okay, it's okay. But so he, you know, he could have had Charlotte live forever. Just to, you know, and as you say, if it were a different kind of novelist and a different, maybe some other person writing it, that would have been a happy ending. But he lived on a farm. He watched life and death. He watched spiders eat other insects. That was a natural way for things to happen on a farm.
Yes, and he had lost both his parents, and he'd experienced the normal amount of loss, but he was also a melancholy sort of person, and he saw the brevity of life as another reason to revel in today and enjoy being alive and awake and conscious today. And so both those themes are completely interwoven.
1-800-989-8255. You say in your title he was eccentric. Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, that subtitle is too long, I admit. I said eccentric because, well, the word originally just means off-center, the Greek origins of it. Mm-hmm. And if ever there was a human being born off-center, it was E.B. White. He simply could not, that was, I think, why Henry Thoreau was his favorite writer. He could not follow in an established path if his life depended on it. And so he had his own quirky way. Fierce and funny hypochondriac. He liked to spend a lot of time alone. He loved working with animals as much as possible. Even in New York City, even in writing for the New Yorker to begin with, he was off, exploring mm-hmm. what rats were doing in some alley.
And that's an interesting part, because that's reflected in the book. The rat is not a fantasy rat. He acts like a rat in the book. He's not reformed in the book.
And that's something I love, too, is that White doesn't pretend to like rats. In fact, Templeton comes out better than the real-life rats did in his life, because he had always felt they were a plague on his life as a farmer, as many farmers do. And I grew up in rural eastern Tennessee, so I'm familiar with this theme. And during World War II, he would shoot rats and pretend at that moment they were Nazis.
Wow. All right. Well,
he's a quirky fellow.
Yeah, well, I can't top that one with anything to say. So let's go to the break. That's a great, good natural break. Talking with Michael Sims, author of The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature, and Birth of an American Classic. If you'd like to discuss it with us, our number is 1-800-989-8255. You can tweet us at SciFry and leave your comments on our Facebook site, SciFry, and our website at sciencefriday.com. Stay with us. We'll be back with more questions and answers after this break.
Support for Science Friday comes from Microsoft, offering programs such as the Imagine Cup to encourage students to change the world through technology. More at imaginecup.us.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flato. We're talking this hour about Charlotte's Web and the man behind it, E.B. White. My guest is Michael Sims, author of The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature, and The Birth of an American Classic. Our number 1-800-989-8255. If you'd like to tweet us, you can tweet us at SciFry. Also, leave some messages at our Facebook and our website, sciencefriday.com. Why was he called Andy as a nickname? Not E.B. or anything like that.
Well, he started at Cornell in 1917, and for a long time, Andrew Dixon White, the co-founder of Cornell, had left a sort of legacy there that he didn't intend to, which is that any young man who was an undergraduate at Cornell with the surname White would get nicknamed after Andrew Dixon White and be called Andy. And E.B., whose given names were Elwin and Brooks, understandably was quite happy with being given a new name. I don't think he wanted to go around being called either Elwin or Brooks. And he adopted Andy and began to introduce himself that way. And even his wife, Catherine, the great New Yorker editor, Catherine White, called him that all his life.
1-800-989-8255. Lots of people, lots of questions. Let's go to Mike in Wichita. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Michael, I've got a question about the title of the book. I'm a teacher. And one of the things we do is we take vocabulary from a story and we ask questions about it. And the title is Charlotte's Web. My question is, what did E.B. White mean by web? Because web can be what a spider spins, but it can also be a plot, like in What a Tangled Web We Weave, or it can mean a connection of people or characters. And as my kids discuss that, I go, do you have thoughts? What do you think E.B. White meant by web?
I think that's a wonderful question. That's why I love call-in. It is so completely unpredictable. He was very well educated, and he was educated in an era in which Latin and Greek were still very much part of the program. And he was very familiar with the Greek and Latin mythological tales of spiders as the weavers of destiny. And the whole idea of Arachne, where they get the word arachnid from, was that Arachne was a weaver who was so cocky about her wonderful skill that the gods turned her into a spider. And the makers of fate are often seen as a kind of spider and weaver. And so he was very familiar with all that. So I really think he was implying a lot of these things, because you see a lot of different uses of references to spider webs over the years in his writing. He once said that democracy is like a spider web in that it stretches and returns to its original place, because that's its kind of resiliency. And so he had was long preoccupied with the web as a symbol. He definitely saw this not only as how she wove the web, but as she rewove Wilbur's destiny. And so I think you're on the right track in asking all of these together, because I really think, clearly from looking at his papers, that he meant all of those at once.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mike, thanks for calling. Good topic. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Lots of people are recounting their experiences with this book, and it's really very interesting to hear their comments. As you say, on a talk show, anything can happen, and we... Our listeners we like that. Let's go to Ed in Birmingham, Alabama. Hi, Ed.
Good afternoon, Ira. Thank you very much for having me on. I just wanted to ask Michael if he would consider writing his next book out of the great natural history of children's stories about talking animals, about the Freddy the Pig books by Brooks. You know those books?
I do. In the 90s and around early in about a decade ago, they were reissued. All of those books were reissued. I own all 26. I own Freddy the Detective in Japanese. So you're talking to the right person. I'm clearly pathologically nerdy. And
well, you're on the right show, at least.
Oh, my God. These are my people. Definitely have always planned to include Freddy the Pig if I do that. Walter Brooks comes up in the E.B. White book because he wrote some for The New Yorker, and he wrote the original stories about Mr. Ed, the character that became Mr. Ed. And so he has another pig who's very smart and interesting, and the stories are very funny and literate. So he's a good point in here. And actually, I'm the only person I know of who has noticed this because of my particular brand of nerdiness, but Walter Brooks, in one of the Freddy the Pig novels, about 8 years before Charlotte's Web was published, had a spider write a bunch of words in a web. And it does not play an important role in the book. It's interesting and an amusing scene, but it had definitely been done before.
Do you think he knew about it?
I don't know. I know that that Brooks wrote for The New Yorker some. White read widely in children's books. The books have been coming out since 1927. I couldn't find that he knew or not. But he does a totally different thing with it, of course.
Yeah.
But it was just interesting to find that it had already been done.
All right, Ed. Thanks for calling. Good question. Good suggestion. What is most surprising to you when you went through all the archives of E.B. White and Charlotte's Web? What was the most surprising thing that you discovered?
I think it's why I'm drawn to this corner in general, and why in a lot of my books I'm writing about how our imagination responds to nature in one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my favorite moment in all of the research and writing was I was sitting in the archives at Cornell going through his papers, and I find one where he's making various notes on that he's learned from different science books about how spiders live, and he discovers that some streamside spiders in a field would build a web low enough that occasionally a small fish would get caught in it. And on this piece of paper, he skips two or three lines, and he begins to turn that into dialogue. And it's that scene in the book where Charlotte recounts it as having happened to one of her cousins. And Wilbur's skeptical, and Charlotte goes, "I have some very remarkable cousins." And I think that's my favorite moment, is you can see the creation right there. You can see the imaginative leap from nature to literature.
Right. And he thought so much of it that there's an illustration in the book, if I recall, of the fish being caught in the spider web.
Yes. Garth Williams, in his wonderful illustrations, had to deal with White giving a lot of advice, including that E.B. White sent him the call numbers for these science books. He would say, check out Volume 3, page 217. The illustrations at the top, Charlotte, looks very fetching.
Do you think there could have been today, in a day like that, there might have been a follow-up, you know? Or can you just say it's a great novel, nothing could be better, don't even try to top this one?
I think it wound up meaning so much to him that he wound up, for example, in this, the pig suffers but does not die, unlike the one that had died. And Charlotte is very much a writer, although, as someone pointed out, she's also sort of a publicist for Wilbur.
Right.
I think it was my publicist who pointed that out, actually. And Charlotte is someone who changes the world with only a few words. And I think by the end, he had identified so fully with her that I don't think he was going to bring mm-hmm. any of those characters back. I think he felt it was as finished as a myth. It was full circle.
And, you know, you see the quality of the writing. And we know about the elements of style and writing. And there is not a wasted word in this book.
Yes. It's wonderful to see. If you look at all the drafts and the false starts, the difficulty the man had getting off the ground, so many variations and versions, so much crossed out. It's beautiful to watch and very inspirational for me as a writer to see someone that you think of as such a model for writing having just as much trouble as the rest of us have and just stacking up the paper, throwing away hundreds of pages to get to this beautiful distilled fable.
And it's an illustration of what a craft and how difficult and what artistry is involved in writing. You know, you just don't sit down there once and put it on paper.
Yes, yes. And it's exciting for me to see that, to watch the creation process evolve, and then also to see what it was sort of like a hands-on craft. I mean, it was in pencil and ink. He wrote largely a lot of it in longhand. The whole first draft was in pencil. And it just feels more like it was connected to the whole history of literature. It's like the way that Lucretius wrote 2,000 mm-hmm. years ago.
Mm-hmm. So where do you go from here? Another book?
I'm already absolutely obsessed with a book about Henry David Thoreau and what he was doing at Walden during those 2 years, how he got there, what he left out, and the emotional mess of his life that had in part led him to go there.
Wow, another nature theme for you.
Another nature and meets literature, another imagination responding to nature. For some reason, I do not know why, that's my corner.
It could, as we used to say, it could be worse.
it could be worse. It really could.
Well, and you know, and I can see it's the way you write it. This is, you know, it's a joy to be able to write about things that you love, and that's be your occupation.
It really is.
Are you going to go live? Are you going up to the pond to live there, or how do you
not to
that?
Live there? But I will be there many times. I've been there a few times in the past, and I'll be there a bunch of times as I write this. To my great embarrassment, I've become one of those dorm room "Follow Your Bliss" posters. It's very embarrassing.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that if you can do it, right?
So far. Check with me 2 years. Who knows?
Well, we will. You think that's about how long it'll take? We'll have you back in 2 years. That'll be delightful.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Talking with Michael Sims, author of The Story of Charlotte's Web, E.B. White's Eccentric Life in Nature, and the Birth of an American Classic. This is, if you've ever read Charlotte's Web, if you're interested in it, I'm now hooked on this book, and I just read it this week. This is a great book, Charlotte's Web, and it's a great commentary by Michael Simon, the author. Thank you for taking time to be with us, Michael.
Thank you. My pleasure.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Up next, Flora Lichtman is here. Hi, Flora.
Hi, Ira.
Our video pick of the week, and They're getting better and better.
This is a doozy this week.
I'm just going to read it off our webpage. You want to see the video? I'm just going to say, go to our webpage at sciencefriday.com. It's up there. It's also on our Facebook page. And the title of this is called Poop and Paddle.
At once.
At the same time.
At the same time.
Describe what this is about.
This is a one-of-a-kind. I think, really, probably one-of-a-kind in the world.
I was trying to think. I was writing those on Facebook saying, can I call this the only one of its kind in the world? And I'm going to – let's say it is.
If someone else has created this, I would like to see it. But the builder and inventor behind this, behind Poop and Paddle, is Adam Katzman. And it's a boat that's also a toilet – it's mostly a toilet, sort of like a floating outhouse. But because it's a boat, there's no sewage pipes coming out of the outhouse, right? So you need to do something with that waste. And what he's built is this constructed wetlands that sort of encircles or fences in the outhouse. And then it's all on the water and there are oars. And it's
great
neat.
Video.
Yeah,
you give us a tour. Think of a raft, like a 10-foot square raft.
Right.
With an outhouse. It's got the half moon on the door.
Yes,
it's
all
got
the classic outhouse iconography. Yes, absolutely. But around the side are these used plastic barrels, and coming out of them are plants. And the way it works is that gravity, it's a gravity-fed system, and so the waste goes out of this marine toilet. You sort of pull this crank, and it goes into these buckets, and it takes 30 days. Adam says he designed it this way, and, you know, there's a lot of technical know-how that goes into this. He studied designs. He read books. It takes 30 days for a flush to make it through this wetland system, and then by the time it gets through, it's clean water that then... You know,
it's growing snails in it to show hyacinth
exactly.
To show how clean the water is.
Yeah.
But when we say it's the only one of its kind, it has a special feature to it that there are paddles that you could paddle the raft around while you are sort of
right. We were thinking
on the throne.
People might line up for this. I mean, in New York, you know, everyone wants to have kind of an experience they can talk about at the next cocktail party. I think I see a future for this. It's parked at this marina in Queens, actually.
Right.
So
can you see? Does he welcome people to come and see it?
I think in the future he's planning to go to a few events.
Right.
And then maybe open it up to the public, let people contribute to the project.
That's maybe people can improve it, make their own. It doesn't look like it's terribly difficult to make.
He said that, you know, you have to know something, but right. but it's not that difficult. And this was sort of the interesting thing for me. You know, if you're going to have a cabin in the woods, for example, so you're not even on a boat, let's mm-hmm. say, why wouldn't you build a constructed wetlands? Then you don't have to clean out your outhouse. It seems like a very reasonable technology for dealing with sewage, which, you know, as we know, especially in New York, mm-hmm. where this is sort of a timely topic because we had all this sewage overflow in the last couple of weeks. You know, this seems like an interesting alternative to waste management.
There's something there for as a teaching vehicle because it shows you how waste can be recycled.
Yeah, I mean, actually, Adam, we were like, why did you do this? and he was pretty clear that this is really more for inspiration than practical applications.
I don't know. We could create a trend. Well, let's ask everybody. Maybe other people will make one, and they could send us.
Yeah.
A photo of it, and we'll put it on our website.
I would like a little Facebook album of alternative toilets.
There's World Toilet Day is coming up,
that's
right?
That's right. I think it's in a couple months. So maybe you have a couple months to make your alternative toilet, and then we'll revisit this topic.
World Toilet Day is in November. I just looked it up. It's in November, and we've got it rolling or paddling, so to speak, on here.
It's going to be hard to top Adam Katzman's design, I think.
You got to see it. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com. It's Flora's video pick of the week. It's up there on our website. You can see it in operation. It's beautifully
not
shot.
Not graphically.
No. Beautifully shot in living color. And Flora, thank you.
Thanks, Ira.
Some of you have asked us, why is it necessary to include ads in these podcasts? It's a good question. The simple answer is we have to find some way to pay for them. NPR does not underwrite our podcasts or any of our social media, like our website or our videos. In fact, they only contribute 10% of our total budget. So instead of charging you for this podcast, we put in a couple of ads. If you'd like to help close that deficit, please go to our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the support button and donate a few bucks. Thanks.